In Louise Erdrich's novel, The Roundhouse, a boy finds out that his mother has been horribly assaulted. He sets out to find out who her killer is so he can be brought to justice. But it's an Indian reservation in North Dakota in the 1980s, and there is no justice for Native Americans, especially if they've been assaulted by a white man. Erdrich returns to the place where she set some of her earlier novels, like The Plague of Doves, about which we spoke with her in 2008. I've long been a fan of Louise Erdrich's work, her stunning prose and memorable characters. And, in my humble opinion, with The Roundhouse, she's hit the literary ball out of the park. It's a masterful exploration of trauma and healing, although there is no anodyne ending. That's because Erdrich wants us to know, perpetrated against Native Americans, and especially against women on the reservations, continues unabated, and justice is still elusive. This past year, Senate Republicans stripped provisions from the Violence Against Women Act that had made it easier for Native American women to report abuse, provisions the Obama administration strongly supported. Louise Erdrich is the author of 14 novels, including The Bingo Palace, Love Medicine, and The Beat Queen, as well as numerous short stories, poetry, and nonfiction. The Roundhouse is out from HarperCollins. Well, Louise Erdrich, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back, as a matter of fact.
Right.
We talked with you last about your book, The Plague of Doves.
Right.
And in this book, you return to the setting of The Plague of Doves, but at a later time. Then it was the early years of the 20th century, and this one takes place toward the end in 1988. Both novels have a terrible act of violence and injustice at their center. Could you talk a little bit about the lineage between the two books?
The narrator of The Roundhouse is the son of Judge Coates and his wife, Geraldine, who get married at the end of The Plague of Doves. The Plague of Doves actually goes from the turn of the last century into the 1970s. So this book takes up in 1988, and we have a young 13-year-old narrator who is really very secure in his family, really a loving kid, you know, an ordinary kid, as he describes himself, who likes to think of himself as a little wild, but who really values his family so deeply. And so this act of violence is going to propel him into an entirely new relationship with his parents, with his friends, and his entire world is going to change in the course of one summer.
He's a very compelling character, as a matter of fact. 13-year-old Joe Coutts finds out that his mother, Geraldine, has been brutally assaulted. In fact, she's been raped. Tell us a little bit about what's going on without giving away too much of the book.
If she had been given a clear route to justice after this assault, perhaps things would have gone differently. But with this assault, she in fact finds with her husband, who is a judge, tribal judge, that justice is very difficult to obtain on the reservation. Now, I knew about this situation for many years before writing the book, and I was tremendously, I guess anybody would be shocked to know that one of three Native women will suffer sexual violence in their lifetimes. About 88% of those acts of sexual violence are committed by non-Natives. Almost none of them are able to be prosecuted because of a tangle of laws that keep things up in the air in terms of who has to prosecute, who is going to be handling the case. It's all jurisdictional issues. These laws make it very difficult to prosecute such crimes of sexual violence. Plus, non-Native people are not subject to be prosecuted by tribal courts. So the tribal court system, in the first place, can't prosecute many people who commit these crimes.
Is that because it can only prosecute people who are from the reservation itself?
Exactly. And they can only prosecute their own tribal members. Now, this was a right that was taken away in a case called Oliphant versus Suquamish. And there has been some movement in the Senate and in Congress to restore some of this sovereignty to tribal nations so that they can at least get some justice moving on reservations. But it's been blocked in the House. So, you know, we still have the same problem now in 2012 that has been going on since even before 1988. I actually chose 1988 because of Joe's interest in Star Trek: The Next Generation. That was the first. That was the first year that the season was out in 87, 88. So I wanted him to be able to talk about his favorite character, Worf.
And we're talking with Louise Erdrich about her new novel, The Roundhouse. It just won the National Book Award in Fiction. I asked Erdrich if anything is being done to remedy the inability of tribal members to sue assailants who live off the reservation.
So restorative justice needs to go through Congress. And that has been, there's a bill sponsored by Senator Leahy that restores some of that sovereignty, but only a limited sovereignty so that cases of sexual violence could be prosecuted by tribal courts. It's not a full fix of that case, but it's a partial fix. And also President Obama he's been extraordinarily knowledgeable about Native issues, and he has signed into law an act which would very much help women to. It's the Tribal Law and Order Act, and he has really been an advocate for Native people and for Native women.
Wow, this is something I don't think that's very well known.
I don't think it is well known. He also signed the Indigenous Rights Declaration of Human Rights, Indigenous Human Rights, which was in process for many, many years through the UN, and our country was the very last to sign. And he did it. He's had Native people working in the White House. I can't say enough about him. I've been astonished at his knowledge of what's going on. He's supported Indigenous language survival. He's done all sorts of things that benefit Native people. He's even given his own money to tribal colleges.
Wow, that's amazing. And this is on top of course, as we know, generations of the most horrendous injustice. A line that you connect in the two books, particularly, I mean, throughout many of the books that you have written, the issues of justice and injustice are ones that you very much delve into. And in this book here, we have Joe, this 13-year-old boy, who decides that justice is not going to come the normal way. He takes it on. Tell us about some of the conundrums that this presents both to him and to his father and his mother.
Well, Joe, of course, is very protective of his mom. I mean, he doesn't start that way. It has to evolve into growing up to some degree, and it's too fast for him. You know, he goes straight from being a kid whose parents are the protective ones into a world where he understands that they cannot provide protection for him. So that at a very immature age, he feels he needs to take upon himself some decisions about justice that really should never be in his realm. And he's one of a bunch of boys, and their main method of transportation, of course, is their bicycles. And they get into a lot of trouble. I really enjoyed writing these guys. I felt very close to them throughout the whole book. And I guess because I was a tomboy, I wrote them into getting into heroic scrapes and troubles and doing things that were just typically like dorky boys. So there's a lot that's actually funny in the book. And although it's a very serious book about the relationship between Joe and his mother and his father, it's also funny.
It's not just funny. I have loved your work ever since.
Oh, thank you.
I've been reading your work for decades.
Oh, thank you.
And I felt that this was, you know, if I can say it, I felt that this was one of, if not your best, of them all. It's hard to say because I've loved every single one, but...
Oh, that's so kind. Thanks.
This one was so powerful. And yes, it was funny. It was completely gripping. And it really tells a story that... a story of justice, injustice, and even revenge. The search for justice that has a really tremendous emotional impact. And his mother, talk a little bit more about her. I mean, she has been so traumatized. She withdraws. She leaves her family emotionally to be on their own. One struggles with this. I struggled with this. I felt like, well, she's got a son. She's responsible to him. What's happened here?
I think very often one that crime such as this is looked upon as really the woman's job to get over it. And especially then, you know, there was not a lot of dialogue or a lot of talk about how one understands post-traumatic stress or how one begins to heal. And she did it the only way she knew how to heal, which was to utterly withdraw into herself. And this is terrifying, of course, to her son and to her husband. But she also has, it turns out, very important reasons for maintaining a silence about this tremendous violence. She's protecting another woman and a child, as it turns out. And, you know, without giving anything away, there is this silence from her in the beginning that is broken by the middle of the book.
Now, the roundhouse of the title, this is a very central place of action. I felt that this was not only a physical place, but a spiritual place as well. I wonder if you could talk about the roundhouse.
It is a spiritual place. And, of course, the circular shape is indicative and reminiscent of all of the changes in the seasons, the growth patterns in the natural world, the way the great, you know, the great circle of the sky, everything is embodied within this particular structure, so that it's a very sacred structure to the Ojibwe, and that's where ceremonies are held. So for this old space to be violated is also an act that symbolically violates an entire people. And it has been said many times that when a nation is never truly conquered till the hearts of its women are on the ground. And that's what's happening. You know, this cycle of violence is so destructive, not only to women, but to entire families.
Yeah, you know, in the papers, I mean, there's been recently a lot mm-hmm. about domestic violence and sexual abuse on Indian reservations. And I think most people get the idea that it's Native American on Native American. So that when you say, as you did earlier, that 88% of the violence is committed by people who are not of the reservation, mm-hmm. talk a little bit about the perception and what this violence does, how it actually impacts whole communities.
One of the reasons it appears in newspapers that to be native violence is that one says there'll be a line that says most of these acts of violence are committed by family members, and what one doesn't immediately think, well, you know, this woman has married a non-native person or is a boyfriend who's non-native. So yeah, there plenty of native families have non-native people in the family. So these people who should be subject to laws on the reservation and are not subject to laws on the reservation are the focus of those particular changes and fixes that should be made in the Oliphant Law. So that's the people who are being referred to.
And when you say that this
the women are being destroyed. I mean, this is, it's almost, one thinks of the rapes in Bosnia or in the Congo. I mean, connect this to the larger system of injustice, the way in which this personal violence reflects the larger. I mean, I know it could be an obvious point, but I don't think it's something that we really feel in our gut until we read a novel of this kind, like The Roundhouse.
Well, I think what has occurred is that there is a historical sense that from the very beginning in this country, Native women were somehow available sexually. You know, you look at the Pocahontas story, you look at all of the stories of the Wild West, and who were the people who were the protected ones? I mean, they were always the immaculately garbed white settler women. And it's the same with African American women. These were women who were somehow more sexually available from the beginning of American history. So that what I see now is history is present at all times. It feeds into the future. And I feel that this, the fact that this has been allowed to continue to occur, has to do with a historical view of Native women.
Now, not all whites are equal. There's a wonderful character in this novel, Louise Erdrich, your latest novel, The Roundhouse. That's Linda Wishkob.
I love Linda. She's a surprise character. Sometimes a character just sort of becomes, she was a very, sort of dumpy, funny little person as she began. And then she became somewhat sinister with her porcupine hair and her little cute little fingernails, her pink fingernail. I mean, she just became more sinister as the book went on, and I really enjoyed her.
Yeah, but she doesn't seem to be ultimately that sinister. I mean,
she's good. She's
right.
Good. She just has, she has a very clear take on the perpetrator of this crime, a very clear notion of who he is, so that by the end she's assisting Joe in what he feels he needs to do.
And she seems to have a very clear take on, I mean, she's white, but was adopted by Native
American. She's adopted by Native American people. And that's a story that's seldom told, but Native people have adopted non-Native people since the beginning. And I've heard so many stories like that. So this is just one instance in which she's adopted into a Native family. She's abandoned by her non-Native family. And she grows up as a Native person in a non-Native body, you know?
Right. Now, on a personal note, you wrote this book while recovering from breast cancer, is that right? That's an incredible feat, I have to say.
Well, I was enormously supported by my family, so I couldn't have done it otherwise. My daughter, Palace, came home. She lives in New York. She came home and cooked, and she cooked everything under the sun, so it was fantastic. You know, she really did that, and my family was so wonderful to me, and if anything informed the book, it really was this protectiveness that they felt toward me.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, you know, I mean, when one's battling a disease like cancer, one is confronting one's mortality, and kind of the bigger lessons of life are a little more vivid and intense. Was there any way in which you feel that your struggle had an impact and an influence on the writing of this book?
Well, I'm sure it did, but then again, I don't want to talk about it a lot because the issue in the book really isn't about me. But I know I went to this book for solace and that I took some very large emotions with me.
So I've heard you talk about revenge as being a theme in this book. I think it's a lot larger than that, but of course, as we've talked about, when you are unable to get justice the normal way, then how do you get justice? You know, what do you do? Could you say a little bit more about that?
I don't really think of it as revenge in this case. It's a case of an attempt to right or to save someone. I mean, he, you know, it's not that it's a pure act of revenge. There is an attempt here to right a wrong, to make some sort of justice come out of a situation in which no justice can be found. It's a case in which this person is backed into a corner. And when that happens, the vengeance that one has to take is as brutally present for the rest of these people's lives, as much so as it is for the person who is the perpetrator of the crime. And that's not how it should be.
How should it be?
There should be justice. An appeal to justice should be made in the court system.
And tell us again the name of that law that now, coming into the world of nonfiction, mm-hmm. what is that law that was stymied by the House and hopefully will be reintroduced?
Well, the Violence Against Women, the Reauthorization Act, has been, it's very hard to say to support it right now because it's been gutted by the House. The provisions in it have been gutted by the House. So when it started out in the Senate, this bill was very much something that one could support. And at this point, the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2012, it's House Resolution 4970, is something that has to be restored to its original form before it should be passed. And I don't know how that's going to happen.
Mm. Well, Louise Erdrich, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about this absolutely stunning new novel of yours, The Roundhouse. I highly recommend it to all our readers.
Thank you so much. And I should say that although, you know, I'm talking about it as a political book, I really fell in love with this relationship. It was such a human story to me, and I miss writing it.
Really? And are you working on another book?
Yeah.
Oh,
I am.
Great. Is it in the same family, the same place?
It will be in the same.
Wonderful.
Same series. It's a trilogy of books.
So you don't really have to let them go?
No, you're right. When I go home, yeah, I'll sit down and start working again.
Oh, great. Thanks again.
You. Such a joy to talk to you. Thanks.
Louise Erdrich. The Roundhouse is her latest novel. Go to writersvoice.net to hear her read an excerpt. And right now, I want to tell you about a great opportunity to give a boost to our cultural heritage in the Pioneer Valley and help Writer's Voice. We have a grant from Mass Humanities for The River Runs Through Us, our special 6-part series exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts. We need to raise some funds to fulfill the conditions of our grant, and we've got a Kickstarter campaign to do it. So head on over to Kickstarter and search on The River Runs Through Us. Any amount of contribution is greatly appreciated. But we're not just asking for handouts. We have some wonderful rewards for your support, including new book titles and autographed books from local authors Susan Stinson and Jacqueline Sheehan. And check out the series at writersvoice.net.